Welcome to the latest episode of On the Case, this time looking at the recent Court of Appeal decision in TFS Stores Limited versus the Designer Retail Outlet Centres Mansfield General Partner Limited and others, in which the court called a temporary halt to possession proceedings between perfume chain The Fragrance Shop and its landlords, citing emergency coronavirus measures. I'm joined by Joanne Wicks QC of Wilberforce Chambers and Mark Gultry of Falcon Chambers, who acted for the successful appellant in the case, TFS Stores. Good to speak to you both.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Jess.
Thanks, Jess.
So the litigation actually predates COVID-19. So can you talk us through the facts of the case and the nature of the dispute?
Yes, it's a really interesting case, actually. It's about the contracting out procedure under the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954, so the business tenancies legislation. And it relates to six different leases of retail units in a designer outlet centre. And the question which is raised in each is, has there been an effective contracting out process followed? And it's all about what exactly you have to put in the form of declaration that the tenant makes when the landlord and tenant agree to contract out a business tenancy. So it was decided in the High Court that the leases had been effectively contracted out, and the appeal is as to whether or not that's right.
However, the pandemic has gone on to have a major impact on possession proceedings in the courts, and central to this case is Practice Direction 51Z. That's an emergency measure issued in response to the crisis. So what is its purpose and how does it operate in practice?
Well, just that, and that was brought in pretty much at the same time as lockdown. Mm. And it was brought in alongside the measures in the coronavirus bill, which were primarily aimed at stopping forfeiture of commercial tenancies. I think it's fair to say we thought it was going to be about residential tenancies only, but when it actually landed, it had a much, much wider scope than that. So basically what it says is, if you've got any possession proceedings brought under Part 55, which we may need to come back to, apart from certain ones against trespassers, then you can't take any steps either to progress that claim or to enforce a possession order if you've already got them. The purpose was said to be twofold at the time. One was to take the pressure off the courts. I think there's 30,000-40,000 possession claims a month, and the staff obviously can't deal with that sort of workload in the lockdown situation, but also to stop the public health risks associated with evictions, especially if they're not consensual evictions. Obviously, it's quite a risky business going into somebody's home. So that was the aim, you know, a blanket ban on all possession proceedings going forwards, apart from these trespasser cases. And it stayed like that, and it's been that way one way and another ever since the end of March. In practice, it's operated as an effective but rather blunt instrument. There are some very deserving cases that you might think would be exceptions to the stay that are not. And there are perhaps some cases where you might think there'd be no harm in the eviction going ahead, but it operates as a stop to those as well. So it's been deliberately blunt, but it has certainly been a blunt instrument.
As a result of the practice direction, things have moved pretty swiftly in your proceedings since the practice direction was issued. So what happened when it came before the High Court?
Well, the tricky thing in this case about the High Court proceedings is we knew before we went to the Court of Appeal that the practice direction operated to stop appeals as well as first instance cases. That's a case called Okoro. And so the question was, well, does that operate in our case? To understand why that's not obvious, you're right, you have to think about what happened at the High Court. When this all started in 2017, it was quite a common situation. Leases were coming to an end on a couple of the premises. Landlord says, your time's up, you need to leave. Tenant says, no, we don't agree. We think we've got the protection of the Act. So the tenant issued protective proceedings to say, can we have an injunction stopping you evicting us? The landlord then counterclaimed for possession on the couple of stores where the lease was already at an end, or the term was already at an end, and then brought a second set of proceedings for all the other stores saying, we want a declaration that when the lease term comes to an end, we can have possession. By the time it got onto trial last year, all bar one of the terms had ended. And so what the landlord and tenant did was, because the High Court had decided that the contracting out had been done properly, which is the point under appeal, they decided it would be sensible to have a possession order that took effect after the end of the appeal. Seemed very pragmatic at the time. Now, obviously, it's much less clear, because what we then had to decide is, well, in this situation where you didn't actually start off the claim by issuing a possession claim, does the stay apply or does it not? So that's what we had to sort of the Court of Appeal about.
Yeah, sounds complicated. So now the Court of Appeal has ruled in the matter. So how did the court approach the case and why?
Yes, so it all happened in fairly short succession because we, the Court of Appeal handed down judgment in the case Mark has mentioned called Okuru, which confirmed that appeals from possession proceedings which had been brought under CPR 55 were also caught by the stay. And that gave rise to the question whether this particular appeal, which was due to be heard on the 24th and 25th of June, was also subject to the stay. And initially that was decided on paper by Lord Justice Lewison, who decided that the stay did not apply. And our client then asked the court to reconsider that. And the Court of Appeal decided that they would hear the reconsideration application immediately before the substantive appeal, so that if they decided the stay did not apply or it should be lifted, then they'd go on to hear the actual appeal. In fact, they decided that the stay did apply and that it was not appropriate to lift it by a majority. So the Chancellor and Lady Justice Asplin decided that the stay did apply and it wasn't appropriate to lift it, whereas Lord Justice Arnold dissented from that. And essentially, the majority took a broad approach to what constitutes proceedings brought under CPR 55, which is the language of the practice direction, and decided that it caught this appeal and these proceedings, even though, as Mark's explained, they had a rather checkered procedural history. They hadn't originally started straightforwardly as CPR 55 possession proceedings, where you have a very a particular procedural regime that you go through. In for both of the cases, they'd originally started without there being a claim for possession being made. And in one case, it had been brought in through a counterclaim. And in the other case, it had been brought in effectively by a tacit amendment, let's call it that, where an amendment had been threatened but hadn't actually been made. But the court decided that ultimately the policy which underpins this stay, which is to, you know, apply this very, we call it a very thick blanket, so a blanket across all possession proceedings that have their origins in Part 55. The court decided that applied to these proceedings, even though they hadn't straightforwardly started as possession proceedings under CPR 55. And also that it wasn't appropriate to lift the stay, even though, you know, the court was there ready to hear the substantive appeal, because it would send the wrong message. Ultimately, if the court is seen to be willing to lift the stay, then obviously landlords are going to try their hand, aren't they, and give it a whirl. And that undermines the very purpose of having the stay, which is to give everybody a bit of a breathing space and not have applications in court and not have tenants having to deal with litigation.
So what are we left with as a position on the ground with respect to these parties, and is there even a likely timescale for when the matter will return to court?
Yes, it looks like it's going to be coming back to the Court of Appeal in December.
Right.
For the substantive appeal.
How wide an impact do you think this particular decision will have?
I think there's a couple of things that it will definitely affect. One is this actual question of how wide the stay is at the moment. And in particular, this point about counterclaims, which looks like quite a technical point, is actually quite practically important. One of the things that Lord Justice Arnold said in his dissent is, well, if this is right, that all these counterclaims are brought under the Part 55 procedure, it means every time, however big the litigation is, there's an element of possession in there somewhere, then all of the rules under Part 55 about the hearing process and about service potentially apply differently. And that's not, in my experience, how people tend to treat it. And it may mean that many more cases are caught by the stay than is thought. And it also may have implications in that way beyond the stay. There may be lots of claims that can be challenged that they've not been brought properly. The other way it seems to me it's going to have an impact is we know now that after the 23rd of August, this current set of rules, staying possession proceedings, will end. Where we are at the moment is we know that there's going to be a new practice direction 55C, which is going to set out new requirements for what you have to do if your claim was stayed. And now we're coming out of it, and there looks like there may be new notices to serve and so on. So it's still going to matter very much whether, as Joanne said, your claim technically was brought under Part 55 and therefore you have to comply with all of these extra onerous requirements, or whether you can just go ahead with it and get back possession if that's what you want to do when we get to September and October. So I think there's at least those two issues. I suspect Joanne's probably got other thoughts as well.
I think it's I think it's really interesting. There's now been three cases in short succession in the Court of Appeal, all wrestling with this question of stay. So Arkin and Marshall, Okuru and now TFS and Designer Retail Outlet, and pretty unusual for a procedural rule to have generated that much high level litigation, you know, in so short a period of time. But I think what, you know, the Court of Appeal is sending out a really strong message that this stay is intended to apply. It's not intended to be lifted easily. And there had been some indication of rather inconsistent judgments, hadn't there, Mark? And certain judges saying, well, I'm going to lift the stay in order to hand down judgment, for example. And the Court of Appeal has rather squashed that and said, really, it's only in the most exceptional circumstances that we'll consider these cases can go forward. And just because, just because you're all ready to go, you've got leading and junior counsel on both sides, you know, the Court of Appeal has read in that that of itself is not enough to say, well, let's just get on with it because of the policy reasons that underpin the stay.
That said, though, I mean, I think it remains to be seen how quickly and how comprehensively that gets played out. Unbeknownst to the Court of Appeal in our case, at almost exactly the same time in the Jarvis and Evans case about landlord licensing in Wales, the Court of Appeal took exactly the opposite view, and they said, this is an important point of law, we need to get it resolved because there's lots of landlords in Wales waiting on the answer, and we're all here and it's better that we get on with it. Now, it may be, as John says, now we've got this very clear judgment that will change, but watch this space, I think.
Inevitably, when it comes to a stay of possession proceedings, it works in the favour of the tenant, really. It buys time and holds the ring, as it were, in regards to the position. And in enforcing it in this way, it's sort of the Court of Appeal seems to be applying the spirit that many courts have of adopting a very tenant-friendly approach to matters such as possession proceedings and winding up proceedings during the pandemic, probably taking their lead from the government on that direction. Do you think a fair balance is currently being struck between the competing interests of landlords and tenants?
You're right, Jess. It's a very interesting question, but it is the rulemaking bodies rather than the courts who have created a deliberately non-level playing field. And in that respect, they're taking their cue from the government, from Parliament, which has legislated to, for example, impose a moratorium on forfeiture of business tenancies or extended the time for taking possession under residential tenancies. And there are legislative provisions now which prevent winding up petitions being taken against companies who are suffering from the effects of the COVID pandemic. So when the practice direction was originally made, 51Z, it was ostensibly predominantly about the public health consequences of lots of people gathering in courts and wanting to protect court users and court staff from the health consequences of numbers of people gathering. What's become clearer now that there's some secondary legislation which introduces this new rule 55.29 is that there is also a social and economic policy underpinning, and that it's about giving tenants and indeed trespassers, because it applies as much to trespassers, or at least some trespassers, giving them a bit of a breathing space so that they don't have to deal with litigation at the same time as having to deal with all of the consequences of the pandemic in their businesses or family lives. So it is deliberately not a level playing field. It's quite, as Mark has said, quite a blunt instrument. There are a number of people who I'm sure feel quite aggrieved that they haven't been able to progress their cases. They feel that they're not being fairly treated, as it were, but it is in order to give everybody a bit of time away from litigation, essentially.
Yes, I mean, I completely agree with Joanne. I think that looking forwards, it does seem like the mood music, at the very least in the residential sector, is towards a more tenant-friendly regime. And when we've got the Renters Reform Bill, which is planning to get rid of Section 21, we've had the Tenant Fees Act, which is trying to put more restrictions on that. And we wait with bated breath to see what we said about leasehold enfranchisement. But it seems that, you know, the landlord and tenant legislation always goes in waves of, you know, 20 or 30 years of tighter controls and more security, and then if the market becomes unworkable, loosening it up again. We've been doing that since 1915. The one remarkable thing about this phase is that it's, I think, the first time that a landlord cannot recover possession no matter how much the tenant is in rent arrears, I think ever, but certainly since the first Rent Act came in. And so that, obviously, it's an exceptional time. I suspect we'll see some loosening of that, but certainly it seems likely that tenants will be protected at least until the economic impacts have calmed down quite considerably.
If and when the stay is lifted, I imagine there might be quite a rush to litigate. It should be an interesting time for you both.
Yes, I think certainly it probably more at my end of practice than Joanne's, because the bread and butter work at of the junior bar is the sort of traditional possession proceedings. As I say, I think Joanne managed to get some figures that is about 38,000 a month normally. So by the time the lockdown lifts, there'll be 100,000 to 200,000 backlog. And one of the interesting things in the explanatory note to these new rules is there's a power to allow the courts to defer certain cases on certain grounds to spread out that big backlog. So I think it's important for landlords in particular to really keep an eye on those new rules, because it may be that certain factors are prioritised, and so they'll need to look and see whether they need to be making representations to say I should be at the front of the queue. Similarly, tenants saying, well, you know, I actually fit into one of these categories that should be deferred for yet more time. But certainly there'll be a lot to get to grips with and a big backlog to clear.
Yeah, there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes. There is a working group that's been set up by the Master of the Rolls, and which has a number of different bodies and interests represented on it, including the Property Bar Association. And difficult decisions are going to have to be made as to how you prioritise particular categories of cases to clear this backlog, because it's going to be massive. And we all know that the courts aren't well resourced. And so it obviously can't be done on a case-by-case basis. So there will be people who feel that their own particular case is particularly urgent and needs to be dealt with more quickly than others. But again, I can only see some way in which certain types of case are going to be prioritised over others. And it may be a very long queue for those who have to wait at the back of it.
Well, we'll await to see what happens, and I'm sure if any particularly major cases present themselves, you'll be here to explain them for us.
Yes, well, we look forward. Perhaps you'll have us back when when we've had the substantive appeal later in the year, and we're instructed by DLA Piper on that one, and looking forward to it, aren't we, Mark?
Yes, very much. I think it's a lot of attention. We think there's something like 50 to 70,000 commercial tenancies will be affected by the answer. So plenty to keep an eye out for on that one.
Okay, well, please do keep us posted. And thanks for explaining this stage of the proceedings to us.
Great. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Thanks, Jess.